Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
I think seeing that worker city, a city of 50,000 people that was completely deserted, a ghost city with the weeds growing up, contaminated, and so silent, was, for me as a geographer, I guess, was a stunning realization.
It's been estimated that there are at least 50,000 plant species existing that have edible, palatable, might be the better word, parts, and at least some of them are demonstrably superior, even without special breeding and agricultural techniques, demonstrably superior than the plant, the crop plants in use.
Penn State geologist Dr. Judith Johnsrud recently returned from a research trip to Chernobyl. She is not advocating the increased use of nuclear power. Others are not so sure. And Harvard biologist Dr. Edward O. Wilson, the disappearance of the world's biodiversity could, at the very least, jeopardize our food chain. Two of our guests and our stories this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. At about 1:30 on the morning of April 26, 1986, a fire broke out in reactor number 4 of the nuclear power station at Chernobyl in the Soviet Republic of Byelorussia. An explosion followed, and within a few days, high levels of radioactivity were detected over Sweden and the rest of Scandinavia. The Soviet government was slow to acknowledge the incident that, when fully known, was called a disaster by the outside world. Though the fire was put out by May 1st, the repercussions of that explosion have been felt ever since. In fact, it may be said the explosion at Reactor 4 eventually collapsed the Berlin Wall, for it was Gorbachev's call for international assistance at Chernobyl that began the so-called Glasnost, which in turn led to the political upheavals in Eastern Europe. Back to our story. The Chernobyl accident, less than 10 years after the near meltdown at Three Mile Island in central Pennsylvania, convinced many that nuclear power is not and cannot be a viable, safe energy source. In the same 10 years, though, the Earth has lost a great deal of its upper ozone layer, has depleted more of its finite reserves of fossil fuels, and has, at least some say, begun a slow warming trend. In light of these ecological developments, it may be time to take a second look at nuclear power. At least, that is what Laurie Hickson contends. Hickson, an engineering and communications consultant with General Public Utilities, based in Parsippany, New Jersey, works in Middletown, Pennsylvania, at GPU's TMI facility. She says we actually learned a great deal from that disaster.
First thing that we learned was, number one, that the disaster could be contained, or the accident could be contained inside the safety systems that we designed around the plant, mainly a large concrete building called a containment building, worked to contain the radiation inside the facility. So that was good news. We learned that our safety systems do work. The second thing that we learned was that we need to take a good look at emergency planning. And we did. Although there was no need to evacuate in that worst case situation, all utilities or all nuclear facilities now have effective emergency plans around that facility. In case there is an accident, which is very unlikely to happen, there are now effective emergency plans that can help remove people if the need arises. Other things we took a look at were training, upgrading training. There was even a group established after the accident called the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, which is kind of the industry self-assessment group. It's a way that the industry can take a look at what we're doing, can analyze situations that occur at the plant, and make sure that an accident like Three Mile Island never occurs again.
31 Chernobyl plant workers died in the initial blast, and in 2.5 hours, almost 50,000 people were evacuated from the nearby town of Pripyat as the radioactive wind swept across the savannah. Perhaps in the case of Chernobyl, the most effective evacuation means was pure fear of death.
It was my rare privilege to be able to visit the Chernobyl plant last fall and to meet with President Gorbachev's science advisor, Evgeny Velikov.
Dr. Judith Johnsrud is a geologist with the University of Pennsylvania at State College.
And I found that they have a very mixed feeling. Clearly, the people of the Soviet Union, as they are now learning so much more about the magnitude of the damage to human health of the what we call the interdiction of land, that is to say, the necessity to evacuate it on a semi-permanent basis because it is too contaminated for people to live there. All of these things have contributed in the USSR to a very strong citizen opposition. The government officials said to us, how do we deal with the people? The people no longer will tolerate, and a number of plants have been shut down and abandoned. At the same time, the USSR is diminishing its reliance on nuclear weapons, on the other hand. They recognize that they have a serious energy problem, and they feel compelled to continue to operate some reactors. But my observation would be that that's beginning to shift markedly in consequence of the public demand for safer, cleaner technologies.
The core of reactor number 4 at Chernobyl contains over 400 pounds of plutonium, with a half-life of 24,000 years. 400 pounds mixed with the burned, twisted rubble now buried under 500,000 cubic yards of concrete, and millions and millions and millions of acres in Byelorussia and the Ukraine are now no longer habitable or arable. Dr. Johnsrud.
They are planning to close down the other three reactors operating at Chernobyl, and we're just starting to see the children with leukemias and blood disorders. Whole classrooms of kids who were in Pripyat. I think seeing that worker city, a city of 50,000 people that was completely deserted, a ghost city with the weeds growing up, contaminated, and so silent, was, for me as a geographer, I guess, was a stunning realization. You know, we can rebuild from a war. We cannot reconstruct from nuclear contamination, radiation damage. And we're facing it with every nuclear facility in this country because they were designed, constructed, operated by human beings. And all of us are fallible, and we seem to forget that.
Charles Bagnall does not want to forget that. In fact, he says we need to remember the mistakes of the past and build on them, literally. He is advocating for the so-called next generation of nuclear power stations. The technology is here, he says. Bagnall is an engineer with Combustion Engineering of Winsted, Connecticut.
Part of the problem in the past has been that things have been overregulated, and it's been very hard for the utilities to keep up with inflation, that kind of thing. But the other side of the story is that power plants have been built on a design-as-you-go basis. In other words, an electric utility will order a power plant. They'll actually start construction when only about 20% of the plant is actually designed. So they set themselves up right away for backtracking, rethinking, that kind of thing.
And cost overruns, too.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So now the idea is to design the entire power plant first and to have at least 90% of that complete before you even start construction.
The annual growth in energy consumption in the nation has slowed somewhat in recent years, down from a high of 7% only a few years ago to about 3% in 1989. Even still, there is increasing concern precisely because of this slowdown. We have become complacent. 23% of our oil is imported oil, and this does not bode well for the nation's energy or national security future, says Bagnall, who is advocating for a greater use of uranium and coal.
In this country, we're lucky to have enough uranium and coal to last for many hundreds of years. And in fact, if we follow the plan they are in Europe, going to a different type of reactor, which actually makes more fuel than it consumes, then we have several thousand years left of nuclear fuel. And hopefully that will be enough to get us onto newer technologies that should come down the pike in another 100 to 200 years that will help us keep going.
Bagnall says that the broad use of so-called alternative sources of energy, wind, solar, geothermal, are just not practical at this time. We just don't have the necessary technology developed yet.
I work for Combustion Engineering. It's a company very much like Westinghouse or General Electric, an energy company. We don't just build nuclear plants. We build nuclear, coal, fossil, hydro, you name it, we build it. And if 50 years from now we're 100% solar, Combustion Engineering, Westinghouse, and General Electric will still be in business. We're doing research and development on all these, in all these fields. I believe the oil companies as well. When the oil runs out, they'll still be in business. They might not be in the oil business, but I think that there will be an Exxon, it may be a solar company, who knows. But these are the kind of things that need to be done.
Bagnell is calling for increased federal spending on research, something that he hopes Energy Secretary Watkins will carry forward. In the meantime, Penn State's Dr. Johnsrud says there is another picture of the future.
We're moving into the 21st century with a dawning recognition that we will have to reduce the amounts of energy that are used in ways that aren't necessary to a good life. And all of us, from air conditioning in New England that isn't essential because the buildings were poorly designed in the first place, to the demand for imported strawberries in January, you know, that's really not a normal thing. And it's a high-tech, high-cost, energy cost. There are so many multitudes of ways in which our society can reduce its dependence on the heavy energy sources. These will include, I think, ultimately moving to a much more bioregional approach to the way we organize what we do and how we expend our energy. A totally different way of living a good life. It's possible. It's not theoretical. It's not a dreamer's fancy. It's what's going to be ahead.
Just recently, the Soviet Parliament announced plans to establish an international center to study the consequences of the explosion, fire, and radiation leak at Chernobyl. One other footnote. On July 3, 1990, 53-year-old Anatoly Grishchenko died in Seattle, Washington. He was the helicopter pilot who flew over Chernobyl to dump dousing concrete on the blaze. After extensive chemotherapy failed, Grishchenko died of leukemia. This is Bruce Robertson. Recently, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission released a policy statement which, if acted upon, would allow some mildly radioactive waste to be dumped in ordinary municipal dumps across the country. Dan Brody has the story.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission's policy statement regarding mildly radioactive waste is a statement of intent, not a deregulation, but it will allow for the possibility of producers of mildly radioactive waste to dispose of that waste without the regulatory controls which they had to go through previously. Frank Ingram, spokesperson for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, described the statement's intent.
Well, basically, what the commission has done is issue a policy statement, the purpose of which is to give direction to any future decisions on which it might make on exempting from some or all regulatory controls the possession and use of radioactive materials that are so low in radioactivity that they do not warrant the same kind of controls that higher levels of radioactive materials do.
Still confused? Well, to clear things up, we talked to another federal agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, to be precise. Richard Guyman, director of the EPA's Office of Radiation Programs, clarified what exactly the statement means to the EPA and to the public.
What we understand the policy to do is to set a general framework for types of exposures that they would consider to be eligible for these exemptions. Now, they've been working on this for a while, and frankly, this concept, if you will, of some degree of deregulation is not a new concept. We've been thinking about some possible applications of it at the Environmental Protection Agency also. I think there's a couple of key concerns you need to have when you're thinking about this type of exemptions. First concern is to ensure that the most exposed people would in fact be exposed to very, very low levels of radiation, and that even if they were exposed to several of these different types of sources that might be exempted, that the accumulated radiation would still be small. Also, you want to make sure that the whole population, that is, potential exposure to thousands or possibly millions of people that might be exposed to exempted things, would also be the total addition of all of that would be very, very small.
What exactly are the likely sources of this additional radioactivity? Well, Guymon says that at this point it is still unclear, but he says that there are many sources of radiation which could soon start turning up in the landfills.
Again, it's not clear yet from their policy precisely what things that they would be considering to exempt, but the kinds of things that might possibly be candidates, and as we look at their policy, it suggests that certain types of waste from nuclear power plants might be exempted. There's certain types of waste, laundry possible waste, certain waste paper, waste clothing that might be used at those facilities. You also might have waste that are generated at hospitals that use radioactive materials as tracers or in therapy. Those are some of the kinds of things that possibly might be exempted. It's until we know precisely what kinds of exemptions they're going to consider granting, we really won't know for sure.
Right now, Guymon says the EPA's major concern is what effects, if any, the addition of this mildly radioactive waste to the landfills will have on the groundwater surrounding the dumps.
One of our fundamental points in addressing that at the EPA would be to ensure that the a lot of these waste streams that might be deregulated would not contaminate groundwater to levels higher than the agency's drinking water standards. And EPA's current drinking water standards say that no one should get more than 4 millirem per year. That's the unit we measure radiation in. And so as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission implements its policy, we would hope that they would implement it in such a way that no groundwater would be contaminated to greater than that amount.
Guymon emphasized that although the NRC has full authority to issue permits which would allow the dumping of this waste in municipal landfills, no dumping could be done that would violate any of the EPA's environmental regulations. He adds that not only must the NRC meet such regulations, but that in order for them to be effective, they must also gain the public's confidence.
A lot of perceptional issues that need to be dealt with here. If it was once radioactive, why is it not radioactive now? Is a question that a lot of people will raise. Those clearly are issues that need to be addressed here, and I think for the policy to be fully implemented and fully useful for people, it's going to have to be done in such a way that that people, I think, have participated in it, that they feel that that in fact they're going to have adequate degree of protection. And that's the key along the way. Obviously, if a policy is put forth and you can't, you ultimately get, states and local citizens and landfill operators and everything like that to refuse to move the waste or pick it up or put it into various operations, you don't have anything that's going to be very useful. So as a consequence of all of that, you've got to have this balancing, and you've got to make sure, I think, that the public has felt adequate input and feels confidence that the governmental programs are providing adequate protection.
For the time being, the NRC will continue to decide on a case-by-case basis what radioactive waste is, in their view, mild enough, and the EPA will continue to make sure that none of their environmental guidelines are violated. And although, as Frank Ingram said,
There really is no change of policy,
there is a situation which could certainly affect our environment. For The Environment Show, this is Dan Brody.
Both the state of California and the city of Los Angeles have recently adopted laws requiring a 50% recycling rate by the end of the 1990s. In practical terms, that means reducing by half the materials going into landfills. From Los Angeles, Joy Newell reports on an initial step toward meeting that goal.
A two-day conference was held recently. Brochures advertising the event titled it Recycling in Los Angeles, Community Involvement. Mary Nichols, director of the Urban Environment Program with the Natural Resources Defense Council, told me about one goal of the get-together.
The goal of it was to talk about ways in which community organizations can get involved in recycling as an economic moneymaker, as a way to fund their organizations and start up small business ventures, and how this kind of activity can also benefit the overall effort to increase recycling for environmental reasons. So it was really a reaching out on the part of an environmental organization to groups that haven't always in the past been involved in environmental issues, and to show how there can be some mutual benefit from doing so.
More than 45,000 tons of trash are produced in Los Angeles every day. And the concurrent goals of decreasing landfill input and decreasing the traffic and energy it takes to transport all that trash to the sites mean that Los Angeles has to develop lots of programs to meet the 50% recycling goal by the end of this decade. Give me an example of a piece of concrete information, a piece of action information that was presented at the conference.
One of the specifics that we handed out was a list of all the government contracts that are going to be let over the next year within the city of Los Angeles that are available for either nonprofit organizations or small businesses to bid on. Not everybody there will be able to bid on them, but some of them will, and some of them may be able to form consortiums with others to bid on them.
Give me an example of one or two of those contracts. What's the government seeking that looks at small business or neighborhood opportunities?
One of the contracts that the city will let will be a contract for actually educating neighborhood organizations and homeowners about the new trash separation program and why people are being asked to do it and what it means. And that is a contract where the city is going to pay somebody, or probably more than one organization, to actually do public education. They'll be paying taxpayer funds to somebody rather than hiring people on staff to try to do public information from down at City Hall. They're going to try to work with one or several contractors to provide this information.
Now, that might mean the publication of neighborhood flyers. It might mean someone going out and speaking to neighborhood groups, church groups, rotary groups, etc.
It could include a speakers bureau, brochures. It could include community meetings, teams of people going door to door. It's up to the bidding groups to decide exactly what combination of educational messages. It could be public service announcements on radio or even on television. All of those things could be included in the public information program.
I was unable to attend the conference, so Nichols had to fill me in on matters like attendance. She says 350 people showed up on day one, and 200 attended workshops on day two.
And this was on one of the hottest days of the year, hottest weekends of the year in Los Angeles. There was a fire in the tunnel under the Hollywood Freeway. Getting there was difficult. The air conditioning broke down in the room, but people were incredibly enthusiastic and involved.
Local community groups heard success stories about recycling going on now, like composting.
Right now in Los Angeles, the Parks Department is already reusing all of its own tree trimmings. They're grinding them up as mulch and using them to cover flower beds to cut down on the amount of water evaporation. So you not only are using stuff that would otherwise be just moldering away in the landfill, but you're also saving on the energy that it takes to transport it to the landfill, and you're cutting down on some of the water demand for irrigation purposes as well. We're looking at ways to expand on that type of activity and to get neighborhood organizations into the business of doing the collecting and the composting. One of the nice things about the conference was that we ran it as a kind of a mini demonstration in and of itself. People were there for two whole days, and they had the coffee breaks in the morning, and they had lunches served at midday. All of the meals that were not consumed, that were still edible, were taken to a homeless shelter. All of the food scraps were put into a barrel and were composted, were taken for composting up at the Tree People organization. So we had kind of an on-site demonstration going on of some of the possibilities here.
I note with some interest that the conference advertising brochures asked attendees to reduce their waste by taking their own coffee mugs to the event. And Nichols says lots of people did just that. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, I'm Joy Newell.
Joy Newell reports from KCRW in Santa Monica. Noted Harvard biologist Dr. Edward O. Wilson believes that included on the top 10 list of crises facing the Earth and its species of plants and animals is the disappearance of those species. He says we don't even know what we're losing.
Astonishingly, we do not know to the nearest order of magnitude how many kinds of plants and animals there are on Earth. This is a largely unexplored planet. It is time for us to land on planet Earth and begin exploring it.
To begin exploring, Wilson brings us down for an extensive look around, down, 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 into the secret life of plants and animals unseen by the eye or mind of man. Wilson asks us to imagine a cross-section of the floor of a typical hardwood forest. Going down through just the first couple of inches is like descending into the depths of the ocean.
Upon close examination, if we will only reduce our scale to the millimeter level, we find entire microsystems involving thousands or millions of organisms, thousands of different kinds of organisms teeming in this jungle over which we walk.
But why should we pay attention to a cosmos that we can neither see nor intersect with? Well, says Wilson, the reasons are multiple and complex, ranging from the biological, medical, and ethical to the very practical.
In the course of history, for example, people have used about 7,000 plant species for food, but they've come to rely heavily on about 15 species alone, including wheat, rye, millet, maize. But it's been estimated that there are at least 50,000 plant species existing that have edible, palatable, might be the better word, parts, and at least some of them are demonstrably superior, even without special breeding and agricultural techniques, demonstrably superior than the crop plants in use.
Wilson says the reason we got so narrow in our palate is that these agricultural crops were the first that our Neolithic ancestors came across and perfected. There was simply no incentive to move beyond. Dr. Edward O. Wilson is professor of science and curator in entomology at Harvard University, and he spoke recently at a conference of scientists gathered at the New York State Museum in the state's capital. Well, that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed The Environment Show. We had help today from Joy Newell and Dan Brody. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.